No, that's not my style.
And I'm supposed to nail down the facts. I usually have to stay more to the real factual stuff with the kind of thing I'm doing. That's sort of my place with things. So I'm a little different than Rick. I can't just start talking off the cuff about all my impressions of everything. I mean, that's not usually what people are looking to me for.
Okay. Second, this one tape recorder seems to be moving too fast. Okay, well, I guess that's just the way it goes. So anyway, today is the 25th of July, and I am interviewing Craig Metkin. So, tell me about your experiences with the oil spill, Craig.
When I first heard that the spill had happened, I was in Seward, and I was my boat was up on the land there. And I was getting ready to go herring fishing because I've herring fished in Prince William Sound, or I had then for the last previous 10 or 15 something years. And I had the same boat, the Lucky Star, and I was in the hold. I remember I had the radio going up there, or I think I just flipped it on, and then I was down, not in the hold, but in the bilge. I'm working on bilge switch pumps and that kind of stuff, and I heard this deal. I remember hearing something about the world's, potentially the world's largest oil spill. And I remember thinking, oh my God, where is that? You know, as if this is some other thing that doesn't impact me. And then I heard Prince William Sound. I couldn't hear the radio that well. And I was like, no way, you know, impossible. And so I didn't know for sure what I'd heard. And I jumped out of there, and there was a Coast Guard office back behind the boat. I remember, and I ran over there and said, you guys hear about some oil spill? And they go, yeah, we heard about some oil spill. We're going to leave here. There's an oil spill in Prince William Sound. And I just went, oh, my God. So I think that was before cell phones. Certainly it was before I had one. And I remember having to go to the phone and then try to call people. And interestingly, Rick Steiner was one of the first people I got a hold of. And he said, yeah, I'm flying out really soon, and we're going to take a look at this thing. And he said, you better get your boat in the water. So I went, oh boy, well, this is, you know, and I was sort of ready to go, but I got real ready. And then I realized I can't just put in the water and leave. I do need to have somebody with me. Olga, my wife at the time, and I had a one and a half year old, Ellie, who was, they were at home. And so I had to call them and said, look, I think I'm leaving to go out to the Sound. I got to figure out what's going on, and you know, and I'm going to put the boat in the water. And Olga was like, well, I'm not staying, you know. So at any rate, she brought Ellie, and I got the boat in the water, and we just took off and headed across. And we came in the western entrance to Prince William Sound. Since we went out of Seward, you got across the Gulf of Alaska. Takes 8 hours or so for that boat. It took 8 hours or so to get across. We came in the western entrance, and we didn't know what was going on. You know, we didn't know what stage things were at. So what we did is pulled into Port San Juan Hatchery, which was sort of in that far southwest corner of the Sound. And people run around like chickens with their heads cut off in there, Chiniga Village and at the hatchery. And everybody's going, well, we got to protect this place because the oil's coming this way, they say. And it'd been, now, by the time we got out there, I think it'd been a couple days since the actual spill. It wasn't immediate that I could get out of Seward. And there might have even, oh, you know, I think what happened was, we ended up not getting out before the storm. You know, there was a 24-hour period, so a fair bit of time, maybe 36, where it was flat calm and the oil was just on the water. And then it blew.
Right.
And we were about to go, and then we got this forecast. It was going to blow like crazy. And so rather than run out ahead of it, we decided we better wait because we had to cross a gulf. So we ended up running out just after this storm. And So it'd been, by the time we really got out to the Sound, it'd been a few days probably. And so we got there and we got to Port San Juan, and like I say, they were just running around like crazy and there were helicopters flying in and dumping this boom material. And there was one other boat, a bow picker, and they were dumping the booms, and then we were loading it. I got in there immediately. You're drafted. They need everybody. Everybody's running and doing whatever. And so we started loading this boom on this bow picker, and then we go out and try to hook it together. Nobody had any idea how this stuff worked. It was ridiculous. And all parts of it didn't fit with other parts. And so what we're trying to do is boom off the hatchery. The hatchery's back in this bay. We're trying to boom off the passage so that the oil would go by and wouldn't come in, because they had all these fish that they had in the water in these pens, and so we're trying to protect the fish. And I'm a fisherman, so obviously that's one of the first things on my mind. So I didn't go right up to the spill site. I was down there, and then at this point, it's after the storm. And they said, "Well, the oil's moving this way, and it's coming, And so for about 3 days, I did that and hooked boom together. And I remember, God, how did that work? There was somehow I ended up doing interviews with Joe Gallagher at KBBI during that period. I don't know, I must have been at the phone at the hatchery in the evening or something. But somehow or another, I ended up getting hooked up with Joe Gallagher, and so I was talking to him quite a bit about everything we were doing. So that went on for a couple days anyway, and we'd hear rumors about where the oil was and how it was coming and blah, blah. And finally, somebody told me, "The oil's now in Night Island Passage. Some boat came in," because now we had more boats coming in, and there were some more people coming around, other fishermen that I knew. And somebody said, "Yeah, I just came down, and the oil's coming down Night Island Passage, and there's killer whales out there." And since I studied killer whales and had for 4 or 5 years before that time, as well as doing the fishing, I was doing that on the side, and that was my graduate work revolved around marine mammals at UAF. So I went, "Oh my God, I got to go out and see what's going on." So we took off in the boat and headed up to Lower Night Island Passage. And I had Ellie and Olga were still out there. They ended up staying for about 5 or 6 days before they ended up going in. But at this point, they were still in the boat. And we went up and into Lower Night Island Passage. And sure enough, we found killer whales. And sure enough, there was oil coming down. And what we saw were sheens and light slicks. That wasn't like the heavy moose type stuff yet, but the killer whales were coming up in this oil, and it was the first like, "Oh shoot, they aren't avoiding this stuff." In fact, I'm writing a paper right now about the oil spill 18 years after and killer whales and whatnot. One of the things I'm putting out there are all the details of how we've watched that they don't avoid oil, and that was my first example of it. And there were quite a few killer whales, and then we went around and we know them all by the dorsal fins and saddle patches, and we started identifying them as AB pod, which is the pod we saw most frequently at that time of the Sound, 35 animals, and they were there and pretty spread out, but going through these slicks, and it was weird. And there were helicopters flying around by then. This is now like 6 days after the spill. And there are helicopters, there's boats. It just, it's a bizarre sort of aura to the whole thing. And it was sort of cloudy, and I just remember feeling like it was, that kind of feeling you get, like, this isn't real. This isn't the way I usually see this place, and there's something wrong. And you could smell the oil too. That, I think, had a lot to do with it. It was a smell, and I remember Olga smelling it, and that's why she ended up leaving. She didn't end up wanting to get into the oil with the baby and all the odor. It was pretty bad, actually. And so we started doing the photo ID thing. That's always the first thing I do when I get on killer whales, and I'm taking pictures of each one. I'm to document who's there and who's not. And pretty soon we realized there are a bunch of missing animals here, and we figured out some of them that were missing, but we couldn't figure them all out. They were spread out. I mean, it's just hard to figure it when you're there, but that's why you take the pictures, so you can look at them later and see just who all was missing. But we knew there were at least four or five. Turned out there were seven missing altogether, and at that point in time. And so we sort of went into a little bit of a tailspin and a panic about where these animals were, because they were young animals. They weren't animals that should have been missing, not like old animals that would die. So that's sort of what happened. And then it got crazy. I went back. There were all these helicopters flying around, and I got calls on the radio. People wanted me to go behind this island. They want to talk to me. I had film crews coming out. I knew some film people then, and I don't know. Everybody was asking about who was out of the spill. They found out I was out there. So Nova wanted me to do this deal. Fish and Game wanted me to charter for them. A guy, Rick Rosenthal, a filmmaker who I knew pretty well, had gotten a hold of me, and a friend of mine who flew, flew him in, and he got on the boat and said, "Look, I really want to get this rolling, and I want to do it now, and will you help me do this?" So I said, "Sure. I got to finish up with these killer whales, and then, you know, tonight, come back in, and we'll take off. We'll start filming. You're doing whatever you need to do." So we did that. He came back, and we started filming. And he said, "You know, we'll get your boat paid for or whatever. I mean, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out, because Nova wants me to do it along with these other people." And so we started doing that, and then we had this director who started flying out and telling us what we were supposed to do. First, we were going up and filming animals in the oil up around Herring Bay. It was unbelievable. You couldn't even go into Herring Bay hardly on Northern Night Island. You couldn't breathe. And that we ran into these guys who had been sent out from Cordova as wildlife rescue guys. They were fishermen I knew. And they were going, "My God, they gave us this thing to put on the boat." And it was this deal that was supposed to register how much hydrocarbon material was in the air, and the thing was off the scale. They're going, "We don't know if you should be in here or not." He said, I don't know if you guys should go in here because you can't hardly breathe. You know, it was awful. And there were sea otters in the oil, and we followed them up into this, or we followed the oil up into this corner of the bay, and there was just dead wildlife. You could see animals. You wouldn't recognize really sea otters because they were so covered with oil. It was like, you know, there'd be like this stream of oily crap, and you didn't know what was garbage, what was sea otters, what was, you know, there was land otters in there, all sorts of things. And these guys were supposedly picking them up, the animal rescue guys, and most of them were dead in this instance. And it was hideous. It was a mess. And Rick was trying to find something other than just dead otters in the oil. He wanted, and also birds. There were a lot of birds in these strips of oil, these tide rips of oil. And these guys were supposed to all pick these up, pick up the dead ones, save the live ones. It was ridiculous. You know, they didn't know what they were doing. They were just set out with no training, no nothing. So we did that a bit, but we had the director from this NOVA program come in, and she was upset because we were all filming a bunch of oil and wildlife, and she wanted us to interview people like Denny Kelso, the big names. He was the head of DEC then, and who else was out there? I just remember him because she had us running all over trying to find Denny Kelso. And it was like, "You got to be kidding me." And Rick Rosenthal, he's getting more and more irritated with this. And she's saying, "We're going to cut off the money." And, you know, he didn't have any money to operate on other than what Nova was promising they would give him. And so he's going, "My God, I don't want to do this. I'm supposed to run around." And finally, we just said, "To heck with it. We're gonna go do our own thing." This was after 5 or 6 days of filming, and filming Denny Kelso finally, which was a big disappointment. Nice guy, but he didn't know anything. He was sitting on the state ferry out there, hadn't even seen the oil hardly. You know, it was like, what?
Now was he fed or was he state DEC?
He was state.
Yeah.
Yeah, state of Alaska. He was the number one on site commander for the state, kind of thing. You know, and so we had a friend who had a float plane. We called him. He came out, Wendell Jones. We said, "We got to fly to town and figure out what's going on and what we can do that's more helpful than this." And so we flew to town, and it was nuts. We got off the plane, this float plane, and, I mean, there were people. I knew Fish and Game people because I'd worked for Fish and Game, so I went in there. And there were just people lined up. At this point, it must be at least 12 days after the oil spill, something like that, 10, 12 days. And we hadn't been to town, you know, since we'd gotten out on it. And this is Cordova now we flew into, the center of the cyclone. And all these people were at Fish and Game and trying to get their boats on. Everybody wanted their boats to be working out there. And, you know, Exxon had an office, and there was a line going to the Exxon office that stretched down the road. It was ridiculous. Everybody trying to figure out either what was going on, or they heard boats were getting paid a lot. So I went into Fish and Game, and the guy I knew there just grabbed me and said, "Oh, we're glad to see you. Where's your boat?" And I said, "Well, it's out in the Sound because we need to do this study on herring, and we need to do it right now." And I said, and I talked to Rick, and Rick actually, although he's a filmmaker, was also a fish biologist. He was a trained fish biologist. He did some great studies up here years ago. And I said, well, I got Rick Rosenthal with me. We'll go do the study. What do you need done? And it was a herring. And they said, fantastic, because we can't get any boats because Exxon's paying $4,000 a day for boats and of your size, and we can't pay that. And I said, that's fine. That's not a big deal. He says, we'll pay the best charter rate we can, but you know, it's fish and game. It's a state rate. And I said, that's fine, whatever. And we'll pay you and we'll pay Rick. So, and we're going to put divers on board with. Oh, and we said, we need divers. So he said, and Rick is a diver. And an instructor, and he said, we need divers because what we're going to do is look at these areas where there's oil and herring eggs and get the herring eggs that were in the oily areas and also some in the unoily areas, send them down to Vancouver and have them hatch them out to see if there's any problems with them, and also look at the genetics within the eggs to see if there are any problems with that. So, at any rate, so we're doing this. In the meantime, somebody, you know, come up to me and said, they're looking for you. They heard you're in town and they need you at the Exxon office. And I said, need me at the Exxon office? I haven't been to the Exxon office. Or I haven't even talked to Exxon. I don't know anything about what they're doing. Oh, no, they need you there. They know who you are and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, okay. So I go up to the Exxon office and they go, oh, yeah, here we have a check for you for the first 10 days on the spill. You know, here's a check for $45,000. And I just went, you got to be kidding me. And they said, no, you were out there at the very beginning, and we're trying to, you know, for that time you spent, we had helicopters writing down your boat name every day and what you were doing and all this, blah, blah, blah. You know, here's a check. And I was just like, oh my God. And we want you to stay on with us, you know. And I said, I quit. I'm quitting. I'm working for Fish and Game. And they said, yeah, you can't do that. I mean, we're going to pay you $4,200 a day or whatever it was, you know, to be out there, and we'll guarantee you'll work through October. I mean, you are one of the first ones out, you get the first shot at this. And I went, that sounds nice. They said, that doesn't sound nice. That sounds like $400,000 is what it sounds like. And I said, you know, I'm doing this fish and game thing, and I don't really want to work for Exxon. And besides that, I'm going to try to get nymphs to fund killer whale work here. And there's just no way I have time to do this. I said, I'm really sorry because I would like to see this cleaned up, but I can't do this. And I just wouldn't feel good working for you guys anyway. And they said, so you're going to quit. And I said, yeah, I quit. Because they said, you're still on the payroll. And we aren't going to wipe you off unless you go in and sign this stuff and quit. So I did that. And then we went to work for Fish and Game and did the herring thing. But the funny thing that I got to tell you, okay, so this is a sidelight. 4 months later, not 4 months, 3 months later, when I was at home, I ended up going back out. We did the herring study, we did killer whale work. We did hauling dead animals around. We did all sorts of stuff. The boat was busy. But basically, I was working for Fish and Game, and then I ended up working for National Marine Fisheries Service after that. Well, but I finally got a break after 3 months. I think I'd been out there, other than my trip to Cordova. I might have made two short trips to Cordova, but I was out on the spill basically for about 3 months before I went in. Well, I go get home, and there are all these phone calls and messages for me, you know, and one of the things was from the Exxon office in Valdez, and it was like, call immediate, you know, emergency. It wasn't emergency, but very important. So I called, and this guy, Toby, who I knew, another fisherman who was working the main guy in the Exxon office there, I said, what's up? And he goes, well, we got this check here for you for $290,000, and I need to know where you want it sent. And I need to, you know, have you just tell me, you know, like what were you do? Where were you? Were you out in the sound the last 3 months? I said, yeah. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, you're doing fish and games thing. They're not paying that kind of money. What the hell? He goes, no, you've been on the Exxon thing since the beginning. I said, I quit. He goes, oh, nobody believed you quit. No one quit. Everyone was fighting to get on. Nobody believed you quit. No one quits when you get, you know. And I said, I quit. And I said, I told him I quit, and I signed a thing that I quit. Well, they said they threw that away. You know? And he goes, just send me an explanation of what you were doing, and I'll send you the check. And I said, look, you know, that's all well and good. You know, I got my first Exxon, you know, I got that first check, which was nice. And it was nice because I gave it to the research group, and we actually had people out there doing killer whale stuff before NIMS funded any of it, because They gave me $45,000, and we had a nonprofit research group, and I went into that, and we got, so I had Eva, other people were out there in these little boats going around to keeping track of killer whales while I was doing other things. And so I said, I did my thing with Exxon at the beginning, and they paid me, and I'm done, and I cannot do this. And the bottom line was, if I was to take that money, and then I was to come out with some study, or the studies, the herring studies we were doing that I'd been part of, and it came to light that I'd been taking money from Exxon, it just would have been a mess. I mean,
the position would have been totally compromised.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't have. Yeah, they would have nailed my ass, which they'd love to do even to this day, as far as all the science stuff goes. And they would have. It would have been. Yeah, I could have just totally destroyed me. And there had been no case against Exxon yet. They hadn't agreed to pay the feds or the state any money. So that's why it was so important. We had this $45,000 up front. That came from my first deal, but I couldn't go and take money for what I didn't do. So at any rate, I had to just tell the guy, tear the check up.
God. Well, so the way that you told the story, it sounds as though that first check, you weren't even under the understanding that you were working
for Exxon. No. The first boats that went out, they had helicopters, and were flying around.
So they just decided,
and they just took the numbers, and they watched us each. They were watching what we were doing. There were only... for the first week, there were not that many boats out there because nobody was ready to go, and most boats were in the water, and they didn't have... And a lot of guys wouldn't go till they had contracts in hand.
Right.
And that actually took some time. So it was really weird that first week because nobody was... there was nobody there.
Well, it was my understanding that the Coast Guard forbade, for the most part, people to go out
there. I don't really know the details because I was there, essentially from the time of that first storm, and I just couldn't figure out, nobody was showing up, and so, at any rate, so they were keeping track of us, and they had people out there keeping track of us and what we were doing that first period of time, and that's why all of us that were out there at the beginning got these checks, because there was no, it was just, they just put you on the payroll, and they figured... They aren't going to turn this down,
right.
So at any rate, it's pretty wild, and So we ended up doing the fish study, and that was satisfying in the sense that I had some great people working for me. I got a couple fishermen to work for me. They basically said, "Look, you got, here's the parameters. This is how much you can pay people, and this is how much you pay for your boat, and go for it. And you need to take one of the fish and game guys from Juneau who set up these kind of studies before." And, you can help him lay out the logistics, do what you want. Rick and I were pretty much in charge and had this one guy as an advisor, and he ended up, I don't think, even on the boat in the end. But then we got a couple of fish and game divers with us, and we went out and did this project, and it was really a gas in a lot of ways. I mean, it was a crazy oil spill thing, but we felt really positive about it, and we, it was just something we could do right off. It had to be done right away because the oil... was coming into these, and the herring were spawning right then, and it was just a crazy deal. And so we did that, and we found out a lot of new things about, for one thing, some of the other predators on herring eggs, because we were in the water a lot. We also shipped these eggs down. They hatched them out. They found there were defects in the eggs. There were there were birth defects that happened because of it, and some pretty severe stuff. And that contributed to the Exxon settlement, which we were pretty happy about. And there were some long-term problems with the herring that did make it, that did survive, but they still had deformities and stuff like this. So that was good to know, and it was part of the reason herring were considered damaged from the beginning. Now there's a big debate about whether there's been lasting damage to herring and all. We don't fish herring anymore, which is a real drag, but... So it was great. It was a good thing. I had a great time with these people because they weren't a bunch of Exxon people or anything else, and we were doing something positive. And then we ended up doing killer whale work after that. So we were running all over the Sound in oiled areas and unoiled areas. And as it turned out, I got a whole team of people out and stationed them in different areas in the Sound to keep track of all the killer whales moving through the Sound. And eventually we got National Marine Fisheries Service money for that. I can't remember whether... It wasn't until that winter. We didn't really know we were going to get paid, but we knew we had our little Exxon grant from the beginning, our little stash. And so it was neat. Eva came down. A friend of mine, Lance, from Vancouver, came up. His wife Kathy came up. They're all experienced killer whale people, and Balcoms came up. Ken Balcom, Kelly Balcom, who are killer whale folks from Puget Sound area. They're still doing work. All these people still doing work on killer whales in other areas. We all worked as a team, and it worked out really well. And so that was sort of the story of the oil spill. I was out there basically till late that fall. I'd only spent a small time amount of time in town. Finally, in the end, I had to start supplying these field camps, so we had to go in and get materials. We were going in and out more, but saw all kinds of amazing things. I mean, you know, watching the beach cleanup was just horrendous. You know, you knew in your gut that this was not the way to do it, and yet you couldn't do anything because they wanted to display all these steam cleaning machines and. Oh my God, it was outrageous. You know, the beaches were just hammered, and you knew this was happening, but what could you say? They were washing oil off, you know. But of course, in the end, they've shown that there's been more damage done by the basic cleaning the beaches with the hot steam and all than there was from the oil itself. So it was hard stuff to watch, and you know, we helped clean up a lot of the bodies of the birds and the otters and in these oil streaked tide rips that would go all through the sound. You know, we're all out there all summer, worse than the beginning. But I remember Chuck Monet, who worked with for Fish and Wildlife Service then, and I remember seeing him in his Boston Whaler. He ran around in that a lot, he and Lisa Roderman, and my God, I remember seeing it, and they had it just chock full of these dead sea otters, and the whole thing, it was a white Boston Whaler, but it was just black. I mean, you know, but not black, but that brown mousse color, because, you know, it mixes with the water. And once it mixes with the water, then it sticks on things. You can't get it off of anything. It's just like, just worse than regular oil. It, just awful stuff. And God, it was the most horrendous sight, you know, but that's kind of thing it was. And then, of course, you had all these ships and all these people coming in and helicopters. We'd be working on killer whales, going down Nylon Passage or something, and all of a sudden you'd look up and here'd be three helicopters falling right over you and coming right down and forcing animals to dive. It was unbelievable. Oh, just no rules. Yeah, there were just no rules about anything. And then you look behind you. One time we had seven landing crafts all following us with these killer whales, you know, and just right on us, you know. And I mean, there were as many as 25 boats out following killer whales around, because these people, you know, they just, oh, they got a skiff, I'm supposed to clean up. Oh, there's some killer whales, let's go do that for a while, you know. They don't, yeah, it was just unbelievable. Yeah, they just dumped skiffs and airplanes and everything in the sound. It was horrendous. Yeah. And you just couldn't believe it would ever end, you know, that this was just going to go on for years. And it did go on for a couple of years, but the first was the worst. It was just absolute and utter chaos. And thank God, you know, now you don't see that anymore, and you do have the quiet. But it must have taken 5 years before it really settled down, you know, as far as the human impact kind of thing, just from the cleanup people.
Let me check this tape.
Yeah, that should have done.
No. Tell me a little bit more about what you discovered. I mean, so there were seven killer whales that you lost track of.
Right.
So what?
Okay, so killer whales swim in these groups. Resident type, the fish-eating killer whales. There's two types, fish-eating, mammal-eating types, that swim out there, same ocean, but they don't associate and they behave totally differently. One eats fish. Well, those are the ones we had the best track of, and you see more of those Prince William Sound than any other type. And so when they're missing from their maternal group, or their group, their mother and all her offspring, when you see offspring or a mother that's gone from this group, then you know they're dead, at least if they're gone over the course of a season. And so we didn't know immediately these animals were all dead, but they weren't with their close relatives, so we were very suspicious that they were dead. And then after a bunch of resites, you realize, well, these animals are gone, and they never come back. We've never had any of them come back or anything like that. So we, because of that fact that they swim in these stable groups, we were able to determine they were dead. We didn't find the bodies themselves. Unfortunately, killer whales sink most of the time. Once in a while you get a floater, but most all of them sink. And we had some on beaches, but most of them did sink. And so we lost those. And over the course of the next, that during that summer. And of course, the next winter, we lost another 6 animals. So we lost 13 altogether up till that end of the winter following the spill there. So we lost a bunch of resident killer whales. We also lost a bunch of animals from the AT1 transient group, which is a group of killer whales that's considered depleted. And it's actually considered depleted after the oil spill. But we lost about 9 animals out of a group of 22 there. And that, we didn't realize, with the transients, they don't always stay in their groups as tightly. So it took years for us to be sure those animals were dead. And actually, some of them did wash up on the beaches. But so we lost a bunch of these transient animals from a very rare population of transients that happens to use Prince William Sound. And we didn't realize what a big deal that was at the time. We were more concerned with the resident killer whales that we lost. But now we realize this group may not recover, and they're probably headed for extinction. So the oil spill didn't cause the extinction. I think they were having trouble anyway. In fact, I'm sure they were having trouble anyway. But the oil spill put the nail in the coffin, the last nail in the lid of the coffin, more or less. And these animals aren't extinct yet, but they may be in the next couple decades, it looks like. So basically, we had loss of a bunch of killer whales at the time or in that period following the spill. And what we think happened is there was inhalation of oil. That's the most deadly way to be poisoned by oil. Eating it can be a problem, and that may have occurred also, especially with the marine mammal eating types who were eating seals that were covered in oil. And that may have been part of the problem with these transients dying. But the inhalation greatly weakens the lungs, and if you don't die immediately, then you tend to die later. And that's why we lost a lot of animals, I think, during that following winter as well, because there was a lot of damage to lungs. And usually killer whales die in the winter. It's their stressful period. And so, at any rate, these losses, like what we saw, were basically we lost 36% of this AB pod, and we lost 41% of the AT1 transient population. You don't see that happen like that here. Nowhere else, and there's a lot of places now killer whales have been studied pretty closely, and including our area. And over the other 26 years, we've never ever seen anything like that in our 26-year study. Nor have people who have studied them for 30 years in Puget Sound and British Columbia and anywhere else. So it's a totally unique thing, and that's why I'm writing it up now, an 18 years following the oil spill. What more can we say about killer whales than we could write at the time? And basically is that these groups have been damaged and they haven't recovered. Yeah. You know, we lost all these animals, and it's really beyond any reasonable doubt now that these were lost because of the oil spill. You know, when we couldn't find all the bodies, people said, oh, fishermen came out and shot them, and this happened and that happened. But, you know, if you look at it in the light of all the rest of the things, and all the rest of the population, and the fact that, gee, these two groups, one eats fish, one eats marine mammals, and they both just crashed the same exact time? How interesting. And they also happen to be the ones that used that western side of the sound more than any other groups at the time. So it's like I say, I'm writing it up, and it'll be published in a scientific journal. It should be this next few months. And I'm just answering review comments. So it's interesting you do this interview, because I'm sort of tying up all sorts of loose ends from over the last 18 years to sort of put this whole thing to bed, in a sense, as far as killer whales go. And the story isn't over, because they aren't recovered, and they probably aren't going to be for a while yet. And the AT1s may go extinct, the transient group. But at least I can sort of say, look, this is to the best of our knowledge what's happened, and this is what's happened in the 18 years following. So,
just for clarification purposes, that AT1, that's just a region, that's how you...
And AT1 transients are this is a thing you want to get straight. It's hard for people to get straight. We have AT1 transient population. It's actually a population that only consisted of 22 animals prior to the spill, and we know that because of the genetics, because we take samples of their skin. And so it was a remnant population that was stable but not increasing or decreasing when we first, before the spill. After the spill, it's gone down, and it may have gone to extinction anyway, but this has definitely hastened it quite a bit. And so, and they're a separate group, and they're a population itself. Okay, then we have this AB pod, which is part of a larger population of resident or fish-eating killer whales. And it had 35 animals before the spill. We lost 33%, 13 animals at the time or immediately following the spill. And they have started recovering, but it's taken them years. We lost a whole bunch of reproductive females and juveniles, so the reproduction was really knocked down. Plus, we kept losing animals for various reasons for a number of years after the spill, totally unlike any of the other pods. All the other resident pods are increasing at about 3% a year. So these guys are still going down, and now they are starting to come back, but at a pretty slow rate, and it's going to be years yet. Here we are 18 years after, and we're still down about, seven animals from where we were before the spill in this pod. So neither have recovered, but the AB pod should recover. They've had some other problems, too, because of social structure changes because of the spill, but I won't get into all that. It's a bunch of more subtle stuff, but certainly there's been pretty much an undisputed effect on killer whales, and hopefully this paper will finish that off. It's and make it all even more clear. But anyway, that's sort of the deal.
Okay. I must say, far more succinct.